Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with cartoonist and graphic novelist Alison Bechtel, author of Fun Home and Are You My Mother, as well as novelist Ronlin Domangue, whose new book is The Mapmaker's War. We'll also hear from Betsy Sharon, who's one of the founders of The Exchange, the new street paper in New Orleans. Alison Bechtel is the award-winning creator of the cartoon Dykes to Watch Out For, which was published for more than 25 years. Her first book, a graphic memoir called Fun Home, was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award, one of the few works to have achieved such distinction. And her most recent book, Are You My Mother, continues her innovative, category-defying work in word and image. She's one of my favorite writer-artists, and it's a pleasure to speak with her from her home in Vermont. Alison, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're always drawing from your own life, aren't you, whether in past or present?
Yes, pretty much.
And you talk about your process. One of the things that interests me so much is that it is literally such a richly layered process. You write as you're imagining the art on the page, and you write on a computer, and you use Adobe Illustrator, and you use photographs as references. So could you describe that briefly for us?
Well, comics is telling stories with pictures. And so that's basically all I'm doing. I just have some sort of complicated technological means that I use. I do write in Adobe Illustrator, which is a drawing program. And I like that, you know, I could just sit and start writing with a pencil on a piece of drawing paper, but working on the computer lets me take risks and try things I wouldn't necessarily try if I had to erase or start a new page. So I've just figured out a way to write in a two-dimensional way on the computer, as opposed to one-dimensional. And by that, I mean just text, just like a word processing program, that one-dimensional point of the line.
And I love it that you see the graphic novel as a 3D object. I think that was something that illuminated me a lot. It opened a kind of door for me into that kind of work. One of the things that I love is that you use these photographs as references, and you're always taking pictures of yourself in the same positions as your parents who have been the subjects of these memoirs.
Yeah, you know, that's originated as just a drawing aid. As soon as digital photography came out, I adopted it in my work because it was a way to get a real easy reference to sketch from. You know, rather than drawing something out of my head and maybe getting it wrong, I could just see what a pose or gesture needed to be. But it has the unintended side effect of having me actually inhabit these characters that I'm drawing. And often the characters, since I write about my family, are my parents. And so it's kind of an interesting way to sort of get inside of their identities a little bit.
Well, I think it's really charming when you do that. I've loved seeing that in your talks when you describe taking your father's pose or being your mother getting out of a car. It's just, there's something really wonderful about that. Now, in addition to your own life and family, you take inspiration from history, especially literary history. And I wonder if you'd talk about some of the illuminating spirits of these memoirs.
In the book about my dad, I turned to some of his favorite authors and books as a way of sort of fleshing out his character since he was dead and I didn't have any way to talk to him. He was always trying to get me to read these books. He was a great reader. And so I started reading Fitzgerald and Proust and Oscar Wilde and different writers who he admired. And I found those people's work starting to creep into my story about my father in a way that was really exciting. It really, I don't know, gave him another dimension. And so I continued working that way. I wrote another memoir about my mother, and I used other texts in that book, too. Virginia Woolf's memoir writing, the psychoanalytic theories of Donald Winnicott. I just like how these other layers of material can enrich my own story.
And they take you to other places. Like, I especially love your drawing of James Joyce and Sylvia Beach in front of Shakespeare and Company in Paris in the 20s. And then you have this marvelous, marvelous drawing of D.W. Winnicott and Virginia Woolf passing each other in Tavistock Square.
That was a fun moment. I was so stuck for a long time in this book about my mother, and I had this sort of breakthrough one day. The exciting thing to me about Virginia Woolf's memoir writing is something she wrote about what it was like to conceive of her masterpiece, To the Lighthouse, and how it just came to her all in a rush.
Uh-huh.
It never happens to me. Nothing ever comes to me in that way that you fantasize creative impulses come to artists. But this was my one moment of inspiration, was imagining, well, what if Donald Winnicott and Virginia Woolf passed each other on the street one day? So I just drew that, and that act of sort of inhabiting each of those characters, imagining them on the square on a particular day, exactly how they might come to pass each other, that was a really fun exercise that got me kind of started.
Well, and when you love writers, you love imagining their lives as well. You know, it's a very special thing to be able to see something like that. Now, reading is important in all of your books. And I especially love, well, in Fun Home, for example, you draw fairly often, literally stacks of books.
Yes, in a way, Fun Home is just a big bibliography.
Well, there is that. And the way you talk about your father's library as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, books were just a huge part of my childhood, and I continue to be surrounded by books. You know, ironically, I don't consider myself a great reader. I have lots of books, but I don't necessarily read them all. I just like having them around.
I know that feeling. I like to be surrounded by stacks of books. In Fun Home, you talk about how, in many ways, books were your guide as you began to explore your own sexuality, starting with The Well of Loneliness. So you draw so many other books like Ruby Fruit Jungle, Lesbian Woman, all those books that were kind of feminist texts and guidebooks at the time. And now, I think a lot of people probably see your work in that way. Do you hear from readers who have taken your text to heart?
I do. It's a very strange and disorienting feeling, but I'm glad that they have comic books and don't have to read The Wall of Loneliness like I did.
There is something about comic books that's just so reassuring and wonderful. And you have published Dykes to Watch Out For in a huge hardback anthology as well.
Yes, that just came out a couple of years ago, sort of a big compilation of all my comics, like 20 years worth of comics that came out a few years ago.
What's next for you?
Well, I'm sitting here actually right now trying to write a proposal for my next book. So I shouldn't talk about it because I should just harness all that energy into the actual book.
Well, it takes you a very long time to write a book. It took you, what, 6 years to write Fun Home?
Oh, my God. I am so abysmally slow. Yeah, I got to speed up. I'm determined to do this next book in a more customary span of time, like 2 years.
And also, your visual language is so distinctive. I always have the feeling that, you know, if I were given a drawing or a story that you had done and I didn't know it was yours, I would recognize it. What was it like for you to finally refine that distinctive trademark look and story?
It's funny. I'm not sure that I have that. I don't see it myself. I mean, you know, I don't even think of it as a style. To me, style implies a certain degree of intentionality, and I'm just drawing in the best way I can manage to by the seat of my pants at any given moment. So I feel like that's constantly evolving, and I'm glad that it has a distinctive look.
Well, it does. And I guess style implies a kind of settledness, and you're always looking forward to breaking new ground in a way, I guess. It's fun and it's hard work all at the same time. We've been talking with Alison Bechtel. You can meet her when she discusses her work, Dykes to Watch Out For, Fun Home, and Are You My Mother? Wednesday, March 6th at 7 p.m. at the Lavin Burnick Center at Tulane University. Thank you so much, Alison.
My pleasure.
Rolland Domang is a Louisiana native who studied creative writing at Louisiana State University. Her first book, The Mercy of Thin Air, was published in 2006, a dreamy ghost story set partly in New Orleans in the 20s. Her new book, is something completely different, the beginning of the myth of a different world. It is called The Mapmaker's War. We're speaking to Ronlyn today from her home in Baton Rouge. Ronlyn, welcome to The Reading Life. One of the things I've always loved about your work is that you seem completely free. You imagine such fascinating things, and in The Mercy of Thin Air, it was a ghost story, but now you've turned to making an entirely new world.
Well, I would say that I don't get to pick my novels, they pick me. So The Mercy of Thin Air was a complete surprise. I didn't expect to write that book. Not that I really knew what my first novel was going to be, but that one probably wasn't what I would have expected. And when I finished The Mercy of Thin Air, I started on a completely different book, and that had to do with the Vietnam War and urban development and ecology, and the fire just burned out of that really quickly. And there's a long story about how this book even came into being, but the short story is, it really did choose me. I was overcome by these characters and their particular world, and they insisted that they wanted to be in ours in the form of a book, and so that's what I've delivered.
Well, I particularly love the main character, Aoife.
Yes.
And she is such a strong character and determined to follow her own inner lights. How much of yourself do you see in her?
I think I share her sense of purpose and her sense of will. I would say she's a bit more aloof than I am. And, I mean, overall, her character came in little pieces over time. I didn't know she was a map maker until she suddenly told me she was. And her story came in little tiny clusters that started to coalesce after time. And then once I started writing, I had a very unusual experience in that with The Mercy of Thin Air, I was able to enter the character spaces, kind of enter their minds and their world. Well, this was the reverse. She entered me. So I got the very clear sense that she was speaking through me, not to me. And there's a big difference between those two experiences of writing.
Oh, absolutely.
So I, where did she come from? For those of you out there who are a little bit into the woo-woo, you know, I'm not sure where she came from. To say that she came straight from my imagination might give me a little bit too much credit, because she came through with a lot of power in a very surprising way.
And I'd love this whole notion of her as a map maker, you know, going against all the conventions of her world, of her time, and determined to know her place on the earth and to map out the contours of her world. It's a really poetic and extraordinary metaphor.
Thank you. Yeah. I had only the vaguest sense of who she was, that she was born into privilege. I knew that. And it wasn't until she decided that she was a map maker that things started to take shape, that I really began to understand that she was a person living in a time, because it sort of feels like the Dark Ages. I mean, that's the easiest way to describe it. So she lives in a time and place where women don't get to be anything other than wives and mothers. And she is quite different and recognizes that about herself, and as a very small child, begins drawing maps spontaneously. Not that she knows what they are, but this is something that's just inherent, that's part of her. And her ability over time to manipulate or work with the relationships in her life to give herself the opportunity to express that in a very direct way, to actually become a map maker. You know, it's a both and. It's both her drive to fulfill what her potential is, and it's also the people around her who allow this to happen, the men in her lives who basically allow her to get to do this. So there's a pull, there's a duality to it.
And she's a very determined character who becomes an explorer, and who also later on in the story, I think we can say this without giving too much away, also becomes an exile in a really marvelous kind of utopian society.
Well, you know, I didn't intend that at the beginning. If I remember correctly, it was actually the man who becomes her husband later, Light, the warrior, who, as a character coming into my consciousness, was directing me to see that aspect of this story and to see a community where people are very consciously choosing to live in peace and cooperation. They don't have strict gender roles in terms of what you get to do with your life, what jobs you do. Caretaking of children is shared both by men and by women. They share all of the resources. There are things called the stores where anything you need, you simply go to a particular building and get it. You move freely from houses. If you need to move, if you need a larger house, you move to it. If you need a smaller house, you move to that. so it was interesting for me, living in our world that we're so familiar with our possessions and the things that we own, to experience, at least in a fictional world, what that would be like to have that freedom and flexibility to know that you live somewhere where everyone is taking care of each other and that you get to express yourself in a way that is true to yourself.
Well, there are things in this book that are also reminiscent of fairy tales. You know, they're poems, stories within stories, a dwarf, dragons. Yes. That's very appealing. That has to have been fun.
And I was in the research phase of working on the book, which would have been late 2006, early 2007. I was reading myths and fairy tales and folklore, and that was just intuitive. I immersed myself in those old stories, and then I was reading about them. So I was reading a lot of Joseph Campbell and C.G. Jung and Marion Woodman and other scholars who talked about these old stories, these old tales, and how they still impact us. And I think it wasn't so much intention, it was just I was feeding myself on that numinous realm. And I think it comes through in this particular book.
And this is only the beginning of the story, with the next part to come in 2014. So how far along are you with the sequel, The Chronicle of Secret Riven?
I turned in the full draft to my editor on January 31st.
And it's a much longer book.
Oh, it is so much longer. The Mapmaker's War is a very Spartan, tight 70,000 words, and The Chronicle of Secret Riven is, right now, 238,000 words. So to compare, Moby Dick is 206.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I didn't plan that. Yeah. I never want to do that again.
And you wrote this book by hand.
Yes, I did. Book.
What possessed you? Did you do that with The Mercy of Thin Air as well?
No, The Mercy of Thin Air was written all on computer, and when I started working on the twins, I called The Mapmaker's War and The Chronicle of Secret Riven the twins, because they're linked. When I started working on the project, I had this sense that I had to write them by hand, and I thought that was going to be just such a waste of time. Isn't it more efficient just to type it? But as it turned out, there was an incredible intimacy of writing by hand. I wrote Aoife's story with purple ink on this really beautiful paper, and I wrote in pencil to write Secret Story. That's the one from The Chronicle of Secret Riven. And what it did was it forced me not to go back and revise everything I'd already done the day before, which is what was my tendency when I wrote on the computer. So I just wrote and wrote and wrote and then typed it up. And then when it was time to revise, I hand wrote all of my revisions and wrote more and just did that spiral. And I don't think I'll ever go back to writing on the computer.
Well, I can't wait for the rest of it. And I'm sorry if it slowed you down at all. That's the only thing I can say.
No, it didn't. Even though it took me forever because the stories were so complicated, I think the writing by hand actually turned out to be more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also been doing a lot of nonfiction writing lately for the website The Nervous Breakdown. Mm-hmm. And you've written some wonderful stuff, especially this four-part series on your relationship with a death row inmate named Feltus Taylor, who was writing his autobiography.
I met Feltus through someone I worked with. She's a social worker who would do testimony in death penalty cases. And Feltus Taylor was her client. And she knew that he was working on an autobiography, and she knew that I liked to write. This was before I even went to graduate school. And she asked me if I would be interested in helping him with it. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, he's on death row. I just don't know if I can do this. But she handed me his manuscript, or at least what he had up to that point, and I read it, and I heard the voice of a genuine storyteller, of someone who had something powerful to say to the rest of us about his experience. And after reading that, I said, okay, well, let me meet him. And so I met him, and that began, I guess we knew each other for about 2 years before he was executed on June 6, 2000.
Well, there's some wonderful writing in those entries, and you can read them at thenervousbreakdown.com. But for now, there's The Mapmaker's War, and next year, The Chronicle of Secret Riven. You can hear Ronlyn Domang discuss her work and get a signed copy Thursday, March 7th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much, Ronlyn.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to speak with you again, Susan. Thanks so much.
In these days of dwindling newspapers, Betsy Sharon and her partner Todd Thaxton find themselves in an unusual position, founding a newspaper starting from scratch. And the newspaper they've begun is very different. It's a street paper designed to provide opportunities for our homeless population and designed to draw attention to some issues that may not always be a focus of the mainstream media. I spent a very happy morning last week at my favorite coffee shop, completely engrossed in the stories covered in this new paper. NOLA Exchange has just hit the streets, and Betsy's here to tell us about this new effort. Betsy, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much for having me, Susan.
It's been a long, winding road to the first issue of
sure
The Exchange. So tell us how you got started in this.
Well, it all started with a book. When the co-founder, Todd Thaxton, was in grad school, he was studying English literature and read Tactics of Hope by Paula Matthau. And in it, she describes her experiences volunteering with Streetwise in Chicago and Spare Change in Boston. And we thought about it, and after reading it, looked for the paper in New Orleans, and there wasn't one. And we were all surprised that there wasn't, so we decided after some deliberation to go ahead and start our own.
And how much time has gone into this?
We started the process in October of 2011. So after we began writing the business plan and creating a nonprofit organization, and it's been about a year now.
That's a great learning curve and a great investment of time and money. You've gathered a lot of really impressive writing talent in this first issue. Tell us about some of your stories.
Thank you. We have some columns by people in the community. Charles Brown, the director of the New Orleans Public Library, wrote a column for us about literacy and the new age of the public library system. We have a column from Mike Miller, the director of outreach at Unity of Greater New Orleans, about his outreach experiences. Katie Rechtall and Ryan Smith, former Times-Picayune journalists and infographic artists, did the cover story for us. And we were able to pull some information from a newswire that serves all the international street papers.
I know. I was very impressed by that. But the variety is so impressive.
Thank you.
And the headline on the very front page is something nobody can ignore, right?
Right.
1 in 5 homeless people are children.
Right, right. That's huge. And in Orleans Parish, about 20% of the homeless population are children.
It's just stunning. It's stunning to think about it. And then there's Todd's wonderful interview with Jesse Pullins. I wonder if you talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Jesse Pullins, he's one of our board members, and he's had his experiences sleeping on the streets of New Orleans back in the 80s, and he was addicted to crack cocaine and slept in front of the New Orleans Public Library. And he talks about his experiences, what made him really want to get off the streets and why he did it. And today he's been sober 17 years. And it's a very powerful interview.
It is. It's very moving. And Jeremy Lyons has done this wonderful story about street busking in the Big Easy.
Yes, Jeremy was a busker in New Orleans in the 1990s for about 5 years. And now he lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But he talked a little bit about the history of busking and his experiences and why he did it.
Mm-hmm. So how's it going early on? It's just been out a week or so, right?
It has. It's been out. We launched February 6th. Right there in the middle of the Super Bowl and Mardi Gras, and it's been going great. We've been building our vendor program for our vendors to distribute the paper on the streets, and it's great. We've had a lot of good reception from the community so far.
So tell us about the vendor program, because this is central to your mission. It's something that makes this paper very, very different.
It is. The paper is published as a means to provide employment for homeless, unemployed, and underemployed individuals. So we run a vendor program, and people can come in and they can go through a training process and earn a vendor badge. And we give them a certain number of free papers to kickstart their sales. And they go out onto the street and they distribute those papers and they keep 100% of the profits.
That's very cool.
It is.
It's very cool. I mean, I've seen this. I mean, papers like this in other cities.
Yes.
So it's about time.
Yeah.
It really is.
It is. There's 122 papers all over the world united by the International Network of Street Newspapers. And we're bringing New Orleans into this international network.
And you chose a very particular theme for the first issue, right?
We did. We chose homeless youth for the first issue. And most of the stories in the paper talk about that topic.
Mm-hmm. It's very important and very, very moving to read.
Thank you.
So where can people get this paper?
Right now, we have about 5 active vendors around town. Whole Foods seems to be a hot spot, so on weekends, you'll probably find a vendor around Whole Foods uptown at Arabella Station. In addition to that, we are distributing to local businesses and coffee shops, so we'll actively work on getting the paper out in other avenues. So you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter to see where you can find a paper around town.
And when will the next issue of The Exchange be published?
May 1st.
And have you already chosen a theme for that issue as
we
well?
We have. Food and health is the next theme.
Excellent food, New Orleans,
exactly.
Of course, for everyone.
Exactly.
Well, Betsy, if the first issue is any indication, there's lots of good reading to come. So congratulations.
Thank you so much, Susan.
We've been talking with Betsy Sharon, one of the founders of The Exchange, the new street newspaper in New Orleans. Thanks so much, Betsy.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Let the Great World Spin by Colin McCann, Tuesday, March 5th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Veronica Cavas, author of Artist in Love, From Picasso and Gillot to Christo and Jean-Claude, A Century of Creative and Romantic Partnerships, appears Tuesday, March 5th at 7 p.m. at the Collins Hotel, part of the 1718 reading series, sponsored by Tulane, Loyola, and University of New Orleans students. Sarah Carr signs Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children, Tuesday, March 5th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. N.S. Patrick discusses and signs The Mysteries of Jack the Ripper, Tuesday, March 5th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, cartoonist and graphic novelist Alison Bechtel, author of Fun Home, Are You My Mother, and Dykes to Watch Out For, appears Wednesday, March 6th at 7 p.m. in the Kendall Graham Room in the Lavin Burnick Center at Tulane University. Today's guest, Ronlin Domingue, signs The Mapmaker's War, Thursday, March 7th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Elsa Hahn signs The Gravy in the Kitchen with New Orleans Musicians, Thursday, March 7th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Poet Bernadette Mayer reads Thursday, March 7th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. C.S. Harris signs What Darkness Brings, Saturday, March 9th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Stephen Ray, author of Finn McCool's Football Club, The Birth, Death, and Resurrection of a Pub Soccer Team in the City of the Dead, discusses his work at 7 p.m. on Monday, March 11th at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Aimee Agresti signs her young adult novel, Infatuate, Tuesday, March 12th at 5 p.m. at Octavia Books. Paul Durrell signs Living the Artist's Life, Tuesday, March 12th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. It's March, and that means it's time to start looking around over at TennesseeWilliams.net to plan your annual visit to the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 20th through 24th at the Hotel Monteleone. Some of the writers on the schedule include playwrights Marsha Norman and John Patrick Shanley. Doug Brinkley, talking about his new biography of Walter Cronkite with Errol Laborde. Dwight Garner of the New York Times. Syndicated columnist Leonard Pitts. Oprah Book Club pick Ayanna Mathis, author of 12 Tribes of Hattie. Noted essayist John Jeremiah Sullivan, author of Pulphead. Pulitzer winner Michael Cunningham, author of The Hours, as well as Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan. It's a great weekend, so start planning now at TennesseeWilliams.net. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.